For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygen's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
So, good evening, everyone, and welcome. For new people, I'm Tygen Layton, the teacher at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, and I'm very happy to have with us tonight Jean Reeves, who's spoken here before, but it's always a pleasure. Jean is a very eminent scholar and practitioner, I would say, of the Lotus Sutra, and the translator of, one of the translators of the Lotus Sutra, but his translation, I think, is especially very fine. It's the one I recommend, having taught the Lotus Sutra numbers of times. So Jean's an old friend and really brings the Lotus Sutra to life. And he's also author of Stories of the Lotus Sutra and a Buddhist Kaleidoscope. Is that the name of it? A wonderful collection of academic, really incisive academic essays about the Lotus Sutra. So Jean, thank you very much for being here and for speaking with us about the Lotus Sutra.
Good evening. It's fun to be here again. I think this has become an annual tradition, but I can't remember how many times we've been here, but it's a few now. And as Tygen Dan has said, I'm fascinated by the Lotus Sutra. And in some ways, I could even say I love the Lotus Sutra. It isn't that I feel or think that other sutras are not important or relevant. I read all kinds of Buddhist texts. But somehow, well, partly it's because I'm associated, I guess you didn't mention, I'm associated with an organization which is primarily in Japan, though it has a chapter here in Chicago as well, called Risho Kosekai. And Risho Kosekai is in a kind of Tendai and Nichiren lineage or tradition, for which the Lotus Sutra is the Bible, or the text. And so when we give Dharma talks in Risho Kosekai, you can refer to other things, no problem. Using the Heart Sutra, or the Kegon Sutra, or any number of other sutras. But when you give a Dharma talk at Risho Kosekai, you're pretty much expected to have your feet planted somewhere in the Lotus Sutra.
If I may, one thing I didn't say in the introduction is that the Lotus Sutra is also extremely important in Zen, especially in Soto Zen. Some Zen places don't acknowledge that, but Dogen refers to the Lotus Sutra very frequently, and so it's very important in our tradition too, even though it's not as obvious.
It's not the Bible for Soto Zen people, but it is. And actually, and maybe someday I should just give a talk on the Lotus Sutra. It's been enormously important in the development of both Chinese and Japanese versions of Buddhism throughout the schools. You go to any kind of Chinese Buddhist temple and you will find copies of the Lotus Sutra, and you'll find people reciting the Lotus Sutra. And maybe that's another difference that we could mention, although it's not part of my talk. The Tendai and Lotus traditions, Nichiren traditions, primarily, like Chinese Buddhism in general, recitation traditions. Meditation, I don't want to say it's not emphasized. In fact, it's being emphasized more and more in Chinese, especially Taiwanese Chinese temples. But in general, recitation is given more importance than, at least in practice, it's given more importance than meditation. So I, for example, years ago when I was a seminary student, about 100 years ago, I did meditation twice a day, quite seriously. And I learned meditation from Vivekananda Society, Ramakrishna Vivekananda Society, Hindu meditator. But nowadays, in Risho Kosekai, very few of us sit in meditation. Mainly we recite, And Nichiren also taught us to recite just the title of the Lotus Sutra. So if any of you are familiar with SGI, their main practice is to recite Namu Myoho Renge Kyo, which is basically praise to the Lotus Sutra. So anyway, the Lotus Sutra has had a lot of influence and a lot of importance for a lot of people, but perhaps especially so for the Tendai. And again, I'm going to get distracted here and giving a history lecture into the Tendai school in China was the school that made the Lotus Sutra the Supreme Sutra. And that was carried forward in some interesting and important ways by the medieval Japanese priest by the name of Nichiren. And it's from Nichiren that in all of the modern, not all, almost all of the modern Japanese schools of Buddhism have arisen. By modern, I mean the last hundred years or so. Okay, so I have, you know, been trained to some extent in a Buddhist scholarly tradition. And the Buddhist scholarly tradition, on the whole, I'm thinking now mainly of Western, but even in Japan, to a lesser extent in China, the scholarly tradition has been very powerfully influenced by Western biblical scholarship. It's not all bad. But that means that there is a tendency to want to understand texts, such as the Lotus Sutra, to understand texts in their historical context. And so an awful lot of energy goes into either one of two things. One is trying to understand the historical setting of the text, which is very, very difficult to do in the case of Indian Buddhist texts, because the Indians didn't give a hoot about history. Thought it was kind of irrelevant. So we really don't know much about the historical setting of any of the Buddhist sutras or early Buddhist texts. We know a little bit more about when you get into the 6th, 7th century, but that's well past the time of the composing of the sutras. The other thing that's emphasized in Buddhist scholarship is etymology. The language of the text and comparing various texts. And in every case, in case of the Lotus Sutra, for example, we're still finding fragments buried in places like Nepal and in northern India. And scholars spend an awful lot of time, in my judgment, an awful lot of time comparing the language of these texts, and it becomes a kind of a major undertaking. Now, my take, and we put this, I think, in the title of tonight's talk, I try to do something different. I really try to understand, and I think I learned this from the Lotus Sutra. Mm. I try to understand what this text means for me. I understand, this is what I call understanding, reading a text existentially. Not for what it may have meant in some historical context 2,000 years ago, not what it may have meant to some linguists even, you know, 600 years ago, but what does it mean for me and for us today? And that's what I call existential reading of the Lotus Sutra, which would be true of any other text, not just the Lotus Sutra. And it's very similar to what Nichiren called bodily reading of the text. He tried to distinguish, on the one hand, between intellectual understanding of the text and what he called a bodily means in understanding of the text, by which he meant, well, one of the most celebrated practices in the Lotus Sutra itself, there are various things that are recommended, copying and reciting and so forth, but the first one is always Ju means to receive. Ji is often translated as hold. And some people have taken this literally. They thought it meant to put sutras in a
on the shelf and hold them in a special case in a temple or in a special room in a, if the temple's big enough. And this meant keeping. You could also translate it as keep. This was understood to be the main practice. My translation for the same word, and I think what the text really wants of us, my translation is embrace, which to me is more emotional, existential, even, it's not more physical, because after all, putting a book on the shelf is a physical kind of act, but it's more human in a way. And so I try to emphasize what I call existential, or what Nietzsche called the bodily approach or reading of the Lotus Sutra. And in an existential reading of the Lotus Sutra, seeing is very, very important. The Lotus Sutra basically, one could say, what is the purpose of the Lotus of any sutra, of any text? What is the purpose of the text? I think the purpose of the Lotus Sutra is primarily to convert us, to get us to change our lives, the way we behave every day. And part of that, and this is to make a long story short, part of that behaving every day is to learn to see. And especially in the case of the Lotus Sutra, to learn to see the Buddha in everyone else. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a very special power, a very special ability. And that's what the Lotus Sutra wants us to do, is to see the Buddha in others. And so tonight I'm going to try to... one other introductory footnote here. Seeing is, of course, quite normally and naturally related to light. And so throughout the Lotus Sutra, and not only in the Lotus Sutra, but throughout Buddhism, we get an awful lot of characters with the name light in them. In the first chapter of the Lotus Sutra, for example, is a story about sun and moon light Buddha. And his successor is called Wonderful Light. And in chapter 8, Kaundinya and 500 other arhats are told that they are all to become Buddha's name, Universal Light. So, and there are others. This is just an example, samples of the use of the term light. So, I want to try to say what I want to say through telling a few stories from the Lotus Sutra. And when we were walking over here from dinner, I told Dan Layton that for some reason preparing, I think it has to do with my getting a little bit older, but for some reason preparing for this talk tonight was more stressful than I think any Dharma talk I've ever given, and I've given several hundred. But part of that was that I was having trouble keeping these stories, the details of the stories in mind. And one way I decided to relieve that anxiety was by deciding that I would read some of these stories to you, or parts of some of these stories to you. And this is a little bit strange for me. Several years ago, I published this book called The Stories of the Lotus Sutra. And I don't know, well, Yayoi wasn't with me. This is my wife, by the way, Yayoi here. Yayoi Reeves, and several years ago, right after this book was published, I did a tour of about maybe 9 or so sites in the United States promoting the book, and I didn't read from the book at all. On none of those occasions did I read from the book, and afterwards people said to me, well, you're supposed to, if you're doing a book promoting tour, you're supposed to read from the book. So I took that seriously, but I took it slowly, and I decided I would do that tonight. For the first time, I read the book a little bit. The Lotus Sutra begins with a story about light and vision. It begins with a setting. This text and others are supposedly preached by Shakyamuni Buddha historically on a mountain in India called Eagle Peak, sometimes translated Vulture Peak, Rajagriha. It's in Bihar in north central India. I've actually been there. About three quarters of the way up the mountain is a flat place that kind of sticks out. There's also a place a little above that which has a rock in the shape of a bird's head. And it could easily be seen as a vulture or as an eagle. And the flat place is about a third of the size of this room. And the text explains to us or tells us that assembled in this area are 10,000 bodhisattvas, numerous shravakas, and all kinds of other people and human beings. In other words, there's a gazillion folks assembled to hear the Buddha preach on Eagle Peak. So after it describes who's there, I don't know if I want to read much of that, but a little bit maybe. The Buddha, we're told, once lived on Holy Eagle Peak near Rajagriha, the capital of Magda, where he was accompanied by a vast assembly, a great variety of 12,000 monks, nuns, lay devotees, kings, arhats, 80,000 bodhisattvas, gods, god kings, dragon kings, asura kings, griffin kings, chimera kings, centaur kings, and many other kinds of fantastic, supernatural, mythical beings. The world was more densely populated in those days, or variously populated, I guess. It was in some ways a richer world. Having preached the Sutra of Innumerable Meanings, I shouldn't take a lot of time on this. The Lotus Sutra has traditionally been understood to have three sutras within it. It's often called the Threefold Lotus Sutra. The middle one, the main text, is the Lotus Sutra itself, and it's followed by a sutra on meditation on Fugen Bodhisattva, Samantabhadra. And it begins with a sutra called the Sutra of Innumerable Meanings. I'm not going to get into that right now, but anyway, this story is telling us that the Buddha has already preached the Sutra of Innumerable Meanings. And having done so, he enters deeply into meditative concentration, samadhi in Sanskrit. Then, to prepare the assembly to hear the Buddha preach, various omens suddenly appeared. Flowers rain down from the heavens. The earth shakes in the six different ways that an earth can shake. And the Buddha, you know, I'm having a little struggle here whether to read or just tell this story. The Buddha has a tuft of hair between his... If you look closely at later, you'll see I have one right here. One hair. That's my tuft of hair. You don't have any.
Sometimes.
But maybe you should. Sometimes you do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mine comes and goes. I have not a tuft. I never had a tuft. I just have one hair, grows out and then falls out and then comes back. But the Buddha has a whole tuft of hair between his eyebrows, and from this tuft of hair, he emits a light which lights up all of the worlds, the millions of gazillions of worlds in all 10 directions, up and down. Compass points and intermediate points. And it enables people in this world to see what's going on in all these other worlds. Not only to see the present, but also, but I don't know, I was trying to think today about how many dimensions this would be. I suppose seeing in the present is three dimensions, right? But if you can see the present and the past and the future, at least aspects of the future, maybe you're talking about five dimensions or something like that. Anyway, The Buddha's light enables people to see what's going on in these other worlds. Then Maitreya Bodhisattva asks Manjushri Bodhisattva. This is a common theme in the Lotus Sutra. Manjushri is the guy who's been around and knows a lot and gets asked to answer questions. Maitreya is very often in the Lotus Sutra, I don't want to say dumb, but not as well informed, not as well traveled. He hasn't been around as much as Manjushri. So here, as this happens many times later, Maitreya asks Manjushri Bodhisattva why the Buddha was displaying such a wonder. And Manjushri goes on to explain that the Buddha, let me read this. Actually, he provides in the next several pages a kind of summary of everything else, of everything that's going to be taught in the Lotus Sutra. But as an abbreviation for, not abbreviation, a summary of it, he says, the Buddha intends to teach the great Dharma, send down the rain of the great Dharma, to blow the conch of the great Dharma, to beat the drum of the great Dharma, to explain the meaning of the great Dharma. He emphasizes that in the past, he has seen many other Buddhas. Manjushri in the past has seen many other Buddhas do the same thing in preparation for delivering a very great and difficult teaching. And among those that he's seen do this is the Buddha Sun and Moon Light. The sutra begins with a story, you could say, I mean, it depends what you emphasize, but with a certain emphasis you can say that the Lotus Sutra begins with a story about light. And it holds this idea of light in a central place throughout the text.
We have Manjushri sitting in front of Shakyamuni, in front of the Buddha.
I was wondering as I was sitting there, that was. I'm not close enough to see.
Yeah, he's sitting on a lion and he's holding.
So there's Manjushri right there on your altar.
Yeah.
In front of the Buddha. And I think you're saying this is a Shakyamuni.
No, it's a Buddha anyway.
It's a Buddha anyway. I kind of think it's an Amida Buddha. But I think Dan's right. It's a Buddha anyway. It doesn't really matter very much. Let me say a few words about chapter 11. You like that one?
Yes, I do.
Let me see if I can read a little bit about that. With no explanation or warning of any kind, Chapter 11 begins with a giant, words literally, the Chinese characters literally mean treasure tower, but it's a stupa arising out of the earth and hanging in the air above this. We still have this big congregation we were introduced to in Chapter 1. And let me read a little of this. It goes on and on about how magnificently decorated this stupa is. It's got all kinds of... It's made of the seven precious materials, sometimes called seven jewels, but none of them are jewels. And, let me pick it up here somewhere. When this stupa emerges from the earth, and sits there in the air or in the sky in front of this big congregation, the gods of the heaven, of the 33 gods, now that's getting a little bit technical and a little irrelevant, but anyway, the gods rain down flowers over the assembly and the whole assembly and the stupa itself. And other gods, dragons, satyrs, centaurs, asuras, griffins, chimeras, pythons, humans, and non-humans, tens of millions of billions of beings of great variety make offerings to the stupa with all kinds of flowers, incense, garlands, streamers, canopies, and music, thus revering, honoring, and praising it. And from within the stupa comes a loud voice praising Shakyamuni for teaching the Dhamma Flower Sutra. Well done, world-honored one. For the sake of the great assembly, you are able to teach the wonderful Dhamma Flower Sutra of great impartial wisdom, the Dhamma by which Bodhisattvas are taught and the Buddhas protected and kept keep in mind, which the Buddhas protect and keep in mind. Is just as you say, world-honored Shakyamuni, all that you say is true. Astonished at these events, the monks and nuns and lay people present are all filled with joy and wonder. The Bodhisattvas, known as Great Delight in Preaching, seeing that no one understands what's going on, asks the Buddha why this stupa has emerged from the ground and such a voice has issued from it. In answer, the Buddha explains that in the stupa there is the whole body of a Buddha. A very long time ago, in a very distant place, he explains, there once lived a Buddha named Abundant Treasures. While this Buddha was still a bodhisattva, he made a vow that after he had become a Buddha and then extinct, if anyone ever taught the Dhamma Flower Sutra, he would have his great stupa rise up before such a teacher, both in testimony to the truth of the sutra and so that he could hear it taught directly and praise the one teaching it. It is, the Buddha says, because he heard the Dhamma Flower Sutra being taught that Abundant Treasures Buddha has come to this world in his stupa. Great Delight in Preaching responds that the congregation would like to see this Buddha who's inside the stupa. The Buddha then explained that Abundant Treasures had also said that if such an assembly wanted to see him, to see his whole body, the Buddha teaching the sutra would have to invite to that place all of the Buddhas embodying him throughout the entire universe. Thus, Shakyamuni Buddha would now need to assemble all of the Buddhas embodying or representing him throughout the universe, that is, all the Buddhas in the 10 directions. Great Delight in Preaching then says to the Buddha that those in the assembly would also like to see the Buddhas from all over the universe. Then Shakyamuni Buddha emits a ray of light from the tuft of hair between his, this is the second time he's done this now, emits a ray of light between his eyebrows, illuminating all those billions and billions of worlds in every direction, so that the congregation in this world can see the magnificence of those other worlds, each with billions of bodhisattvas and with a Buddha in each of them preaching the Dharma. Then, after this world has been suitably purified and decorated for such a visit, each of these Buddhas, accompanied by a bodhisattva, comes to sit before the Buddha on the great lion seat at the foot of the extremely tall jewel trees. I realized later on that every time in the Lotus Sutra, at least, and I should do more research on this, every time that a Buddha travels somewhere, he brings a bodhisattva along to carry the suitcase. But there are not enough of these seats. These assembled Buddhas from the other worlds, but there are not enough of seats in this world, even for the Buddhas and their attendant bodhisattvas from just one direction, let alone from 10. So Shakyamuni Buddha must purify billions and billions of worlds neighboring this world and prepare them with lion seats under the great tall jewel trees to receive the many Buddhas and bodhisattvas. And when that is not enough, he does the same thing with billions and billions of additional worlds neighboring the already greatly expanded world. The whole area is transformed in this way into a single Buddha land. You know, all of these lands with different Buddhas are understood to be Buddha lands. After they were all seated, each of the Buddhas instructs their attending bodhisattvas to go to Shakyamuni Buddha and ask him, "Are your illnesses and troubles few? In spirit and energy, are you well? And are your bodhisattvas and shravakas at peace?" And after greeting the Buddha and making flower offerings to him, they all tell him that their Buddha would like to see the great stupa opened. Then the whole congregation, watching intently, Shakyamuni goes up in the air to the stupa and with his right hand opens its door. And from the stupa comes a loud sound, the kind of sound that you hear when the bar is removed from a huge gate. And immediately the whole congregation sees Abundant Treasures Buddha sitting on a seat in the stupa as if in meditation with a still perfect body. Now, it's even clearer than in my telling of it in the text. We're told several times that this Buddha is extinct. This means he's dead, cremated, and gone. But he is sitting in meditation in the stupa, and he praises Shakyamuni Buddha, saying, well done, Shakyamuni Buddha. You have preached the Dhamma Flower Sutra gladly, which is what I have come to this place to hear. The congregation then celebrates by strewing a great many beautiful flowers before the two Buddhas. Then, invited by Abundant Treasures to do so, Shakyamuni enters the stupa and sits down beside Abundant Treasures. And if you've ever looked at much Buddhist art in museums, this is a motif that is fairly common in both China and Japan and brought to Western museums. Because traditionally, in traditional Buddhism, there never can be two Buddhas together. There never can be two Buddhas at the same time and place. That's a strict rule. So here you get another one of the many cases in which the Lotus Sutra decides to break the rules and have two Buddhas sitting side by side within a stupa. And one of these Buddhas is extinct. But now, since the two Buddhas are high up in the stupa in the air, those in the congregation on the ground can't see them very well. And they want to be raised up into the air also. Sensing this, Shakyamuni Buddha raises everyone up in the air. This whole big congregation is all raised up in the air. And for Nichiren Buddhists, this is the beginning of a very special kind of situation which they call the ceremony in the air. But the text doesn't have such a notion. Shakyamuni Buddha raises everyone up in the air and expresses his desire to have someone to whom he could entrust the teaching of the sutra. That is, he wanted to have others promise to teach the sutra after his extinction. The Buddhas who have come from all the directions, the Buddha explains, all use skillful means to ensure that in their own worlds the Dhamma will last for a long time. So who's going to do it in this world is what the Buddha wants to know. Now the Buddha asks, will anyone come forward and vow to receive and embrace, read and recite the Dhamma Flower Sutra so that it will live for a long time in this world? I can see this is going to... I'm going to run out of... What time are we supposed to quit?
Well, I don't know about ever quitting, but, maybe...
8:30?
Yeah, because I won't have time for discussion.
Well, 7 minutes, yeah.
Maybe you could, another story and some interpretation. It's enough to maybe to say what this is about, this mummy Buddha.
The point of this story is really quite simple. And then we'll switch to a couple other stories, and I'm going to stop reading. I think I can tell these stories faster than I can read them. The point of this story is quite simple. It wants to make the point that the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, though he was buried and cremated, and his ashes were distributed maybe in 10 different stupas, it wants to say in chapter 16, this is going to come several chapters later, it wants to say that that Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, this Buddha, still lives. Or at least he lives if you make him live. If you make him, bring him alive, he's still alive. And it sort of sets the stage for this by saying that this abundant treasures Buddha, though dead, long, long, long ago, died and cremated and his ashes distributed, though he is extinct, he's still alive in some way. And that's basically what this story is about. And let me just mention the title of the text, the title of the chapter. It's how many of you know Japanese besides J.O.? A little bit. Well, it's Ken Hoto. Hoto is treasure tower, literally. And that's a word for tower is used quite often for stupas. But the first word is Ken, which is just another reading. It's a Chinese reading of to see. So the title of the chapter is trying to tell the reader, or the hearer, that this is not just about the treasure tower, it's about seeing the treasure tower. And it's through seeing the treasure tower, well, it's only through seeing the treasure tower that you can see that the Buddha is still alive. It's the seeing of the Buddha in the treasure tower that makes him live. These guys, bodhisattvas and others, with whom the Buddha's in conversation, they want to see this, the whole body of this extinct Buddha, because seeing him is what makes him alive for them. In other words, abundant treasures, Buddha, who's long ago extinct, becomes alive when someone sees him as alive, when he can influence them. Now, quickly, just two more stories, because we've got about 5 minutes, so I want to just mention two other stories, which I think are probably even more important than this one. Chapter 12. In fact, I think I'll tell two stories from chapter 12. Chapter 12 is called, I think in English we say Devadatta, but probably should be Deva. But anyway, everyone in Buddhism knows that Devadatta is the epitome of evil. He's tried to kill the Buddha 3 or 4 times. Probably it's an historical fact that he tried to split the order. In fact, he was probably more conservative than Shakyamuni Buddha and wanted to have a more strict application of the rules of the monastery. But in any case, in this chapter of the Lotus Sutra, none of that is even mentioned. Instead, the Buddha tells a story about a time when the Buddha was a king. It's interesting in so many cases that former lives of the Buddha is a king. He was a king, and he was a king who was looking to become awakened, and he promised if anybody would help him understand the Dharma, he would serve that person forever. And a seer comes along and promises to teach the Dharma to the Buddha, and to the king, and the king turns his kingdom over to his son and becomes a servant of the seer. Interesting word here, through the rishi, I don't know. I'll stay with seer. He turns his kingdom over to his son and becomes a servant of the seer, and gradually the seer helps him become awakened to the Dharma. And the Buddha explains, the Buddha's telling the story, the Buddha explains, in a former life, I was that king. And Devadatta was that seer. So thanks a lot, Devanatha. I owe everything to you. And you too are going to become a Buddha named so-and-so living in such and such a world, such and such a time. That's basically the end of, that's basically the whole story. Now, superficially at least, on a normal reading of this story, it's about Devadatta. That's the name of the, that's the title of the chapter. It's, so we could say the story is about Devadatta. But I think it's not about Devadatta. I think it's more a story about the Buddha. It never tells us that Devadatta is going to become a Buddha because he became a good guy, or because he sat in meditation, or because he praised Shakyamuni Buddha. It's got nothing to do with what Devadatta does and is. It's the Buddha who can see the Buddha in Devadatta. And it's really a story trying to tell us what it means to be a Buddha. A Buddha is one who can see. A Buddha is one who can see the Buddha in someone else. And I think that's what this story is about. It's a story telling us that to be a Buddha is to be one who can see the Buddha in others. Now that story is followed by one of the more interesting, one of the most interesting, all of these stories are interesting. It's followed by the story of the dragon girl. Some of these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who traveled to this world from other worlds are getting ready to pack up their suitcases and go home. And Buddha tells them, well, hang on for a minute. Manjushri, who's been doing a lot of traveling around, is going to be here in a few minutes, and you need, you really need to meet him, see him. And so Manjushri appears, and there's a little bit thing there about how many, what's he been doing down under the sea? Has he really been working, or has he been playing around down there? Manjushri persuades them that that he's been busy converting people. And I'm going to have trouble remembering that guy's name. Accumulated Wisdom, Bodhisattva, asked Manjushri, in all of your travels, you've been all over the place, in all of your extensive travels, have you ever met anyone who is capable of becoming awakened instantly? Manjushri says, well, let me think now. Oh yeah, there's a girl, 8 years old. She's the daughter of the king of dragons who lives in the sea. And he goes on, now here I would have to read the text to remember all of the details, but he goes on in great details about all of the virtues of this little girl. And he winds up by saying, she is capable of becoming awakened. A little hard to know for sure how to translate this, but instantly or instantaneously or immediately, quickly. Well, Shariputra, who's the head of the Shravakas, sort of representative of traditional Buddhism, he says, you got to be kidding. A woman's body is too filthy to receive the Dharma. Never mind become awakened or enlightened or become a Buddha. This is just impossible to believe. You've got to be kidding. And Accumulated Wisdom Bodhisattva, who sort of, in this case, the spokesman for all Bodhisattvas, he said, yes, surely this is a joke. It took Shakyamuni Buddha generations and generations for to become awakened. Surely you can't expect a young girl to do so immediately. So these two guys, these two men, express all kinds of reasons why it's impossible to believe that a young girl could become a Buddha quickly. Well, the girl appears. I don't have this all in exactly the right order, but anyway, the girl appears and she takes a necklace from her neck and she hands it to the Buddha. And And she turns to those two guys and she says, did he take it quickly or not? They said, well, yeah, he took it quickly. And she says, and this, I think this is the whole point of the story. She says to these two guys, just watch. Look with your, here again, the translation is a little difficult. Look with your supernatural or your special powers. And you will see me become a Buddha as quickly as that. And sure enough, the girl goes in the southern direction. She puts on the body of a man. Buddhas all have male bodies. And she emerges on a lotus flower. And she's preaching the Dharma and saving countless human beings. And the whole congregation, including Shariputra and accumulated wisdom Bodhisattva, are astonished. And they believe that they have seen the girl become a Buddha. Well, again, this story is often called the story about the dragon princess, the dragon girl. And it is about a dragon girl. But it's more about, I think, it has much more to do with these two guys. The dragon girl teaches the two guys how to see. She teaches them that if they look and see the Buddha in her, they will become awakened themselves. So this, I think, is to cut out most of what I was going to talk about or thought I was going to talk about. This is what the Lotus Sutra is about, teaching us, using stories to teach us to use our, well, I think it has to do in part with the imagination. Seeing with the imagination. Here's this little girl. Or here's this evil guy. To be able to see, to use our imaginations, our creativity as human beings, to see in other people, whether they be the mean boss that we have to face every morning, or the rebellious teenager that we come home to every night, or whoever it is, or just the person sitting across the aisle from us in the subway car, if we can learn to see in everyone we encounter the Buddha potential that is in them, then we have become like the Buddha. We have become ones who can see the Buddha in others. 5 minutes late, we'll stop there and give you time for some discussion.
Thank you very much, Gene. Yes, this seeing the Buddha and others, we're doing next Sunday a Bodhisattva precept ceremony, and I think this is also in many ways at the heart of Bodhisattva precepts. Comments, questions, responses, discussion, please feel free. Jeremy.
So at the beginning of some of the chapters, there's a list of present bodhisattvas, and many of them have names that are more so like actions, or they're things that can be perceived. Like there's a Buddha that gives off, or a bodhisattva that gives off smells. Or there's the moon and sun bodhisattva.
Sun and moon light, yeah.
Right? There are these different bodhisattvas that don't...
There's none that refers directly to smells, though.
I think it's a different sutra. But anyway. But I have this feeling that they're not... it's not to be read literally, like these are people with these names. Rather that they're awakening beings that can be seen in what's being described. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's okay if it helps you to understand the text to see that. In most cases, the names of the bodhisattva, at least in my reading, but the names of the bodhisattva is not very significant. But there's one really, really major exception to that, And that's the Bodhisattva, which we can translate as the regarder of the cries of the world, most commonly known in Chinese as Guan Yin, Guan Se Yin, and or in Japanese as Kanon, Kansei On. And this, in this case, well, this would be another whole Dharma talk, but we're advised that that calling on the name of the Bodhisattva will help us out of difficulties. There's a long list of different kinds of difficulties you can get into. And calling on the name of the Bodhisattva will protect us from those difficulties. Now, I think, not everybody would agree with this, but I think that what this has to do with is that the name, regarder of the cries of the world, one who is compassionately taking account of other people's difficulties, calling that name is to take that name, take that action, which is what you were mentioning, is to take that action seriously. And it is, therefore, to call the name of Guanyin is to be compassionate, I think. So in some case, at least in that case, I think the name of the Bodhisattva is terribly important. But in a case of somebody called, like we were just talking about, accumulated wisdom, I don't think it's all that significant. There may be some others where it is, more or less. But in the names like Manjushri and Maitreya, not very important. We hardly know what those words mean. I won't get into an art history lecture now, but there aren't so many really famous bodhisattvas in East Asia. Guanyin is one, or Kanon.
We have two images in this room.
One, that's Kanon there.
And this is Kanon too? Also, yeah. It's hard to see, but if you go look closely, those are both bodhisattvas of compassion.
Anyway, this is Kanon, yeah. And I'll take Dan's word for this one being two.
That's the 11-faced Kanon.
This is what?
The 11-faced Kanon.
Well, it is.
Yeah, you have to look at it closely.
You have to see it from closer than where I'm sitting. But anyway, I think most of these names, in this case, the name is enormously important.
And we chanted that, I don't know if it was last week or the week before, the closing of that chapter 25 of that Bodhisutra, we chanted recently.
And if you don't tell anybody, I'll also tell you that as I was preparing this talk yesterday or the day before, I was thinking, I was going to say a little bit about chapter 25, which is the Guanyin chapter, but just before the Guanyin chapter is a chapter of, in Japanese, Myo-on. Literally, wonderful sound. And I translated that because I was thinking, what kind of sound does a human being make? It's certainly not farting or burping or, you know, a lot of kind of sounds we make. It certainly isn't, that isn't what it's talking about. So I decided to translate it as wonderful voice. But I've lately come to the conclusion, by lately, I mean a couple of days ago, come to the conclusion that I really should have translated this wonderful sounds, Bodhisattva. And that's because there is a sense in which we can understand that Bodhisattva's name to be, affirming the importance of music. Or maybe you don't know, traditionally in Buddhism, music is not used. Chinese began to use it, but in Indian Buddhism, music is one of those pleasures that a good Buddhist should do without. Many of us think that was a big mistake. So it's important that in this Mahayana Sutra, we would have a Bodhisattva called Wonderful Sounds. So I'm willing to move in the direction of saying that some of these names can be important, but I think many of them are, at least as far as we know, are maybe not so important.
So, other responses, comments, questions? Anything? Please feel free.
How did you first come across the Lotus Sutra, and what was your first reading or reaction to it? Because frankly, so much of it from sort of a Western perspective is just crazy.
Well, yeah, of course it is. I became the head of a theological school at the University of Chicago, where there had been a tradition of Risho Kosetai clergy going to school. And, the founder and then president of Risho Kosetai made arrangements to come and visit me in Chicago. And in preparation for that, that school is a Unitarian Universalist school, and in preparation for that, a workshop was held at the Unitarian Universalist General Assembly that year in Rochester, New York. And the workshop would be on the Lotus Sutra. So I figured the president of Risho Kosetai is going to come here. I better read the Lotus Sutra. I read the first English translation from Chinese into English by Buno Kato, which is really quite remarkably good given it was the first one, but it's not very good anymore. And anyway, partly because of the translation, I think, but partly for a couple other reasons I'll mention, I didn't like the Lotus Sutra at all. One of the reasons I didn't like it, not for what you said, not because it has fantastical stories, that I thought was wonderful, at least. Because the stories, these fantastic stories, like the beginning, I mentioned earlier about the assembly at Eagle Peak, and it's just a little space, about a third of the size of this room, and there are thousands and thousands of people assembled there. Well, I think the original hearers of the Lotus Sutra would have known. They would have been there. They know this. This is one of the ways in which the sutra is telling us this is a story. Don't take this to be history. This is a story. This is feeding your imagination. It's kind of giving you some life, not just some dead history. Well, so that didn't bother me, the story. I thought that was the best part of the Lotus Sutra. Still do. The two things that bothered me, I'm trying to remember what the two were. I can remember what one was for sure. I thought the sutra... yes, I know what the two things are. One of them is that there are a lot of passages in this sutra praising itself. And that's just not very Japanese. It's just too immodest with respect to itself. Now, I understand some ways now why that is the case, but that's one of the things that turned me off when I first read that text. The first thing that turned me off was the strange English. We now have the term, I think generally everybody's accepted the term that I use in the translation, skillful means, is a central teaching of the Lotus Sutra. In Buno Kato's translation, that's called tactfulness. Well, you see, that's just bad English. I mean, it's got nothing to do with tact. Tactfulness just doesn't work as English in that case. Well, a lot of other things like that. So I was turned off by what I would call poor English choices. Kato didn't speak English himself. And after he got through translating it, the publishers hired two other guys to review it and to edit it. One of them is a guy I know quite well, an Italian, who he can speak a little bit of halting English, but he too is hardly an English speaker. And the other one was another Japanese who doesn't speak English. I've never heard him speak a sentence. He's still alive in Tokyo today. So that was part of it, was the English. Part of it was the self-praise. And this probably would take to do it right would take longer than we have now, but there's also a couple of places in the Lotus Sutra, one in chapter 23, one in chapter 28, which come very, very close, at least, to blaming the victim, to saying that people who now have, what do you call that disease where people lose their fingers and stuff?
Leprosy.
Leprosy, thank you. People have leprosy or missing teeth, or there's a whole list of things. It's kind of suggesting, if not saying outright, that that's because of something they did wrong. So there is a couple of places in which you could say, at least those were for me, kind of turnarounds for Lewis.
Just to comment on a couple of those things. I love the Lotus Sutra too. There are parts of it that I don't like so much. But the one point that you were talking about, the what you called the immodesty of the Lotus Sutra, that was sort of a turnoff, but also just puzzling to me at first. It took me a while to get into the Lotus Sutra, and I think that's actually for great historical teachers, Hakuin, the great Rinzai master, thought the Lotus Sutra was garbage when he first read it as a young man, and then 20 years later realized it was the king of sutras, he said. Just the example of this, of the story about the treasure tower, the stupa.
Yeah.
There's something about that I love and that appeals to the imagination is part of why I like the Lotus Sutra, because there's something that's mind bending and really interesting. Well, first there's just this, it's like the mummy returns, you know, there's this extinct Buddha that suddenly appears, and you know, but there's also this quality of what it's saying is that this extinct Buddha appears, vows to appear whenever the Lotus Sutra is being preached, and it says so right in the Lotus Sutra. And there's this quality that happens again and again in the Lotus Sutra that's kind of like an Escher picture, where it just turns itself inside out. And there's something about that really undoes our, you know, Western rational way of thinking about things, that I think is actually inspiring to the imagination.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I really like about the Lotus Sutra. Once you kind of make the leap to hearing it said that way, that it's not about immodesty, it's about, hey, this is the Lotus Sutra, and there's all these things that happen in the Lotus Sutra that talk about, that's a prime example, this stupa appearing whenever the Lotus Sutra is being preached, as it says in the Lotus Sutra itself. So what do you do with that mentally?
I think that what the Lotus Sutra means by saying whenever the Lotus Sutra is preached, because...
Which means it'll be preached again, and it's been preached before. Yeah.
For the Lotus Sutra, all of these kinds of things like being a bodhisattva, being a Buddha, preaching, teaching, all of these things are interactive.
Yeah.
You cannot be a teacher in a closet. You cannot be a Buddha in a closet. To be a Buddha is to be a Buddha for someone. And so the Lotus Sutra, when it says the Lotus Sutra is preached, it doesn't mean that somebody's just preaching it. It means that somebody is actually taking it in. Their lives are being transformed, and that they are, to use a modern term, empowered.
Yeah.
And I think that the Lotus Sutra is primarily an empowering book. That's its intention. That's what it's trying to do, to enrich our imaginations and to empower us to, in the context of tonight's talk, to see.
Yeah, to see Buddhas.
To see Buddhas.
Yeah.
And there are several references in the text where it says somebody saw 10,000 Buddhas. Well, yes. Yes, that is the goal, is to see 10,000 Buddhas.
I once went to a several-day retreat or whatever given by Thich Nhat Hanh about the Lotus Sutra, and at some point as he was talking, I don't remember at all what he was saying, but he was talking about the Lotus Sutra, and suddenly I just realized I was at Eagle Peak hearing the Lotus Sutra. It was just, you know, there I was.
Thich Nhat Hanh, by the way, published a book about the Lotus Sutra a couple years ago. I think, or last year, right? Not long ago. He, unfortunately, he makes some mistakes. He tells stories from the Lotus Sutra from memory, and like me, when he does that, when I do that, we make mistakes with details. But anyway, it's good. It's a good book. Other comments or questions or concerns?
I did want to say one thing. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I just have a question about... So in the last story, you talked about the girl who... Dragon girl. So, but she said that if you use your supernatural powers, you can then see Buddhas, or you can see...
You can
Buddhas
see inside. Me. You can see me become a Buddha.
So does that imply then some kind of... Was she implying some kind of visualization process, or was she more saying if you reach some kind of enlightenment organically, then you'll be able to see Buddhas in heaven?
Yeah, well, I think, you see, when someone sees the Buddha, or the potential, see, in the Lotus Sutras, to see the Buddha in someone, when the Buddha sees the Buddha in Devadatta, he's seeing something that you don't see with your eyes. We do get sometimes in China, we get assemblies of arhats, lohan, and there's always one who's pulling his chest open to reveal the Buddha inside. But that's to take the whole thing a little bit too literally, I think. But the point is that we can only see your potential to be a Buddha by using our imagination, by seeing beyond what we conventionally see, by seeing deeper than what we conventionally see in you. So I think that what when she says use your, I don't know if supernatural is maybe not the best translation, special powers, I think she's talking about the powers of the imagination. See beyond your conventional thinking. See beyond what you are the way you normally think, and see that in that girl, in that a girl whose body is too filthy to receive the Dharma, a girl who's been living under the ocean, see in that girl the potential to be the Buddha. That's a powerful act of the imagination, and very special. I think that's what that's about.
I have to comment on the prejudice that's in the old Buddhism about women, and that's not what the Buddha said, and that's, you know, a cultural thing from patriarchal Asia, and we still live in a country. We live in a country now where there's currently an attack against women, and so I just that's part of a cultural legacy, and that nobody should take that literally.
Well, even if you take the Lotus Sutra as a whole, there is a chapter about the future becoming a Buddha of both the Shakyamuni's stepmother and his wife, his former wife. And there is this story about this dragon girl. But other than that, we've got, until chapter 28, for example, we've got several stories about fathers and sons. But in not one of those stories is there a wife or a mother or a sister. So I would argue that, on the whole, the Lotus Sutra itself is not very generous toward women. And that the Lotus Sutra, we need to understand that the Lotus Sutra, no matter how much we love the Lotus Sutra, we have to understand that it too has serious limitations.
Yeah.
And it's a product of a certain cultural and historical time and place. And I think that the Lotus Sutra itself takes a step beyond most of the texts that come out of that same period. But it's only a little step.
So we do have to close, but I just, you know, it's important to make that point, and I'll be talking more about this, and that we're actually living now in a kind of golden age of women Buddhist teachers. There's really quite a great array of very fine women teachers in Buddhism now, so I'll be talking more about
this. Yes and no. When you talk about this, I hope you don't forget that in, say, Taiwan, where most Buddhist temples are run by nuns, where women have transformed Buddhism into a relevant, contemporary, relevant religious tradition, it's still the case. It's still the case that the most brilliant, I know one nun who has two PhDs, the most brilliant, advanced in practice Buddhist nun has to be subservient to the most ignorant, stupid, youngest monk around.
That's true, and that's very sad, and that's part of the Buddhist monastic tradition in Asia.
Sure.
And so we have to recognize that stuff and look at it. So.